Welcome to SCOTUSCast, a project of the Federalist Society for Law and Public Policy Studies. Our contributors join us from around the country to bring you expert commentary on U.S. Supreme Court cases as they are argued and decisions are issued. The Federalist Society takes no position on particular legal or public policy issues. All expressions of opinion are those of the speaker.
Thank you for joining us for this post-argument episode of SCOTUSCast, Sentencing Reasonableness in Plain Error Review Edition. I'm your host, Grace Gotchling. On December 10, 2019, the U.S. Supreme Court heard argument in Holguin Hernandez v. United States, a case involving a dispute over whether making a formal objection after pronouncement of the defendant's sentence is necessary to invoke appellate review of the reasonableness of the sentence's length. In 2016, petitioner Gonzalo Holguin Hernandez pled guilty in federal district court to possession of marijuana with intent to distribute and was sentenced to 24 months of imprisonment, followed by 2 years of supervised release. As a citizen of Mexico, he also admitted to being unlawfully present in the United States. In October of 2017, after completing his term of incarceration and starting his supervised release, Holguin Hernandez was removed from the United States. In addition to the condition that he not commit another federal, state, or local crime, the terms of the supervised release required that Holguin Hernandez not illegally re-enter the United States. In November 2017, Holguin Hernandez was arrested by Border Patrol agents, admitting to having carried marijuana into the United States from Mexico, and again pled guilty to possession with intent to distribute. He was sentenced to 60 months of imprisonment and 5 more years of supervised release. The U.S. Probation Office then alleged that Holguin Hernandez had violated the terms of supervised release relating to his initial conviction and sought revocation. In a subsequent hearing, he admitted the violations and was sentenced to 12 months of imprisonment, to run consecutively to the 60-month term of imprisonment for the second drug trafficking offense. Although Holguin Hernandez's counsel argued against a consecutive sentence during the hearing as unnecessary in light of the considerably longer drug trafficking one, counsel did not formally object or seek reconsideration after the judge imposed the revocation sentence. On appeal, the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit affirmed the sentence. Although Holguin Hernandez argued that his sentence was longer than necessary to effectuate the statutory factors to be considered when imposing a sentence, the court reasoned that he had not actually raised the objection in district court and therefore the sentence would be reviewed for plain error only. The court found no plain error, indicating that the sentence fell within the guidelines range and noting the guidelines recommendation that a term of imprisonment for violation of supervised release be imposed consecutively to any other term the defendant might be serving. Another Federal Circuit Court of Appeals had taken a different approach, however, and the Supreme Court subsequently granted cert to address whether a formal objection after the pronouncement of sentence is necessary to invoke appellate reasonableness review of the length of a defendant's sentence. And now, to discuss the case, we have Daniel Guanera, associate at Kellogg, Hansen, Todd, Feigl, and Frederick.
Federal courts hand down about 70,000 criminal sentences a year, and, unsurprisingly, it's not uncommon for a defendant to disagree with the sentencing court about what punishment is appropriate under the law. On December 10th, the Supreme Court heard oral argument, including from a court-appointed amicus, in Holguin Hernandez v. United States, which asked the court to resolve a lopsided circuit split about exactly what a defendant must do to preserve for appellate review the argument that a sentence is too harsh. Given the frequency of criminal sentencings and sentencing appeals, criminal practitioners will want to watch this case closely to ensure that they're preserving their objections and receiving the most favorable possible standard of review on appeal. A short summary of the development of sentencing law provides helpful context for understanding the issues in this case. In the early and mid-20th century, most states and the federal government followed an indeterminate sentencing model that gave judges broad discretion to decide on sentences. In this model, judges were viewed as having special expertise in crafting individualized punishments designed to rehabilitate offenders. Sentences were constrained only by statutory sentencing ranges, and appellate review was highly deferential. By the late 1970s, however, a bipartisan consensus emerged against indeterminate sentencing, driven both by persistently high rates of crime and recidivism, and concerns about racial discrimination and arbitrariness. Advocates settled on a policy solution. sentencing guidelines that constrained judicial discretion. In 1980, Minnesota became the first state to adopt guidelines, and Congress passed the Sentencing Reform Act in 1984. This statute created the U.S. Sentencing Commission, which was tasked with creating mandatory sentencing guidelines prescribing sentencing ranges for each federal crime. The Supreme Court upheld the constitutionality of the commission over Justice Scalia's memorable dissent in Mistretta v. United States, in which he labeled the commission, quote, a sort of junior varsity Congress, end quote, that exercised lawmaking authority that the Constitution had vested exclusively in Congress. Sentencing decisions were initially reviewed for abuse of discretion on appeal, but Congress later required sentences outside the guidelines range to be reviewed de novo. The sentencing world was turned upside down in 2005 when the Supreme Court held in United States v. Booker that the guidelines' mandatory nature violated the Sixth Amendment jury right because the guidelines' ranges depended on factual findings made by judges rather than juries. For example, if a jury convicted a defendant of fraud, that generally meant that the jury found each element of the crime had been proven, but it did not answer other questions that fed into the guidelines' calculation, such as the number of victims, the amount of money lost, or the sophistication of the offense. To remedy this constitutional flaw, the court held that the guidelines would henceforth be merely advisory. Judges must still start the sentencing process by calculating the guidelines range, but they are then free to decide for themselves what sentence, inside the guidelines range or not, is appropriate. More specifically, under Section 353A of the Sentencing Reform Act, judges, quote, shall impose a sentence sufficient but not greater than necessary to comply with the purposes set forth in paragraph 2 of this subsection, end quote. And paragraph 2 references, in effect, retribution, deterrence, incapacitation, and rehabilitation. The idea that judges must impose a sentence that is sufficient but not greater than necessary has been labeled the parsimony principle. Section 353A identifies other factors that courts should consider as well, including the nature of the offense and the need to avoid sentencing disparities. Post-Booker, a defendant's claim that a sentence was unjustified under Section 353A is reviewed for abuse of discretion. The theory is that district courts know more about the facts of a case than appellate courts, so appellate courts ask merely whether the sentence was, quote, substantively reasonable, end quote. According to data from the Commission, in fiscal year 2018, there were about 3,200 appeals of an original sentence, and only about 10 of those sentences were reversed or remanded because the appellate court found the sentence substantively unreasonable. It is far more common for appellate courts to find procedural sentencing errors, with miscalculations of the guidelines being the most common procedural error by far. With this background, let's turn to the facts of the case. Gonzalo Holguin Hernandez was on supervised release from an earlier drug offense when he was convicted in the Western District of Texas of drug trafficking. He was sentenced to 5 years in prison for that crime, and the government then moved to revoke his supervised release. The sentencing guidelines called for Holguin Hernandez to receive a 12 to 18-month sentence for having his supervised release revoked, to be served consecutively to his 5-year sentence. Holguin Hernandez's lawyer argued that his sentence should be 0 months, or at least less than 12 months, because the 5-year sentence he'd already received would sufficiently deter him from committing future crimes, and because Holguin Hernandez had committed his drug crimes out of economic necessity and under threat from a cartel. The court was not convinced and sentenced Holguin Hernandez to 12 months in prison to run consecutive to his 5-year term. After imposing the sentence, the court asked Holguin Hernandez's lawyer if she had anything further to say, and she answered no. Holguin Hernandez appealed his sentence. In any circuit other than the Fifth, the fact that Mr. Holguin Hernandez's lawyer had argued for a sentence lower than the one he ultimately received would have been sufficient to preserve the argument that the court's sentence was an error. This would have allowed the appellate court to review the substantive reasonableness of the sentence under an abuse of discretion standard. But the Fifth Circuit is an outlier. The Fifth Circuit holds that it is not enough for a defendant to argue for the sentence that, in the defendant's view, is sufficient but not greater than necessary under Section 353A. The defendant also must object that the sentence that the court actually imposed was substantively unreasonable. So even though Holguin Hernandez's lawyer said that she thought 0 months was reasonable, under Fifth Circuit precedent, the lawyer should have objected that the 12-month sentence actually imposed was substantively unreasonable and explained why. Now, the failure to raise this post-sentencing objection does not mean that Holguin Hernandez's sentence was entirely unreviewable. Rather, under Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 52B, a claim of sentencing error that was not preserved through a timely objection is reviewed for plain error. In theory, this is a slightly more deferential standard than abuse of discretion, though as we'll see, some of the justices seem to doubt that there's an actual difference. In Holguin Hernandez's case, the Fifth Circuit held that there was no plain error given that the sentence was within the guidelines range. The Stanford Law School Supreme Court Clinic got involved in Mr. Holguin Hernandez's case, and the court granted cert on the following question. Quote, whether a criminal defendant who argues in the district court for a lower sentence must formally object after pronouncement of his sentence to preserve a claim for appeal that his sentence is substantively unreasonable. The Solicitor General agreed with Holguin Hernandez that the Fifth Circuit approach is incorrect, so the court appointed an amicus, K. Wynn Allen from Kirkland & Ellis, to defend the Fifth Circuit opinion. Petitioner and the government raised three main arguments against the Fifth Circuit's approach. The first is that the Fifth Circuit rule is simply incompatible with Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 51. Rule 51B says, quote, a party may preserve a claim of error by informing the court when the court ruling or order is made or sought of the action the party wishes the court to take or the party's objection to the court's action and the grounds for that objection, end quote. Petitioner and the government emphasize that Rule 51B says that a party can inform the court of its preferred action either when the ruling is sought or, disjunctively, the party can object after the court takes action. But you don't need to do both. In their view, because Holguin Hernandez explained to the judge why a zero-month sentence was appropriate, his claim is preserved because he informed the court when the sentencing order was sought of the action he wished the court to take, here to impose a zero-month sentence. Petitioner and the government note that Rule 51A reinforces this interpretation. Rule 51A says that, quote, exceptions to rulings or orders of the court are unnecessary, end quote. According to Black's Law Dictionary, an exception is an objection made after an initial objection or proffer is made and overruled. Exceptions date from common law practice in 12th century England, where typically the only material that was available for an appellate court to review was the final judgment itself. This prevented meaningful appellate review in many cases, so courts allowed parties to preserve pre-judgment objections for appeal by filing bills of exceptions that listed and described the court's pre-judgment legal and factual errors. However, the need for bills of exceptions waned as new technology allowed court proceedings to be transcribed, which created a robust record for appellate courts to review. When the Federal Rules of Civil Procedure were adopted in 1938, and then the Federal Rules of Criminal Procedure in 1944, both held that exceptions were no longer necessary. According to petitioner and the government, a rule that required a defendant to object after a judge rejected, and thus effectively overruled, a proposed sentence amounts to an exception. The second main argument advanced by petitioner and the government is that the Fifth Circuit rule confuses the role of the sentencing judge and that of an appellate court. In their view, the job of the sentencing judge is to apply the parsimony principle and identify the sentence that, in the judge's view, is sufficient but not greater than necessary to serve the purposes of sentencing in Section 353A. In other words, the sentencing judge's job is to identify the single best sentence, all things considered. In contrast, on appeal, the job of the appellate court is not to identify the single best sentence in the appellate court's view, but rather to decide whether the sentence is within a range of sentences that can be described as substantively reasonable. Petitioner and the government argue that it therefore makes no sense to ask the sentencing judge to determine, in the first instance, whether the sentence he or she imposed is within a reasonable range, because that question only arises on appeal. The petitioner argues that there's no other area of law in which a party has to advise a trial court that it has violated the appellate standard of review. For example, if a party objects to the admissibility of a piece of evidence and the court overrules that objection, the party does not have to say, Your Honor, by overruling my objection, you have abused your discretion. And that's true even if on appeal, the question would be framed as whether the district court's evidentiary decision was an abuse of discretion. The third main argument by petitioner and the government is that there's no practical value in requiring a separate objection to the substantive reasonableness of a sentence, because typically, the defendant would have just informed the court of his or her preferred sentence and the reasons for that sentence, minutes before the substantive reasonableness objection would have to be lodged. In fact, petitioner says that there is no example of a court in the Fifth Circuit changing its sentence in light of a substantive reasonableness objection made after sentencing. The court-appointed amicus's primary argument in response is that there are really two separate inquiries at sentencing, and an objection to each is required in order to present the court with fair notice of the defendant's concerns. First, a defendant must offer his or her preferred sentence, and then second, once the sentence is imposed, the defendant must separately explain to the court exactly why, in light of the sentencing factors and relevant facts and circumstances, the sentence that was imposed is outside the range of reasonable sentences that Section 353A allows. The reasons why the defendant prefers one sentence and the reasons that an actual sentence is outside the range of reasonableness could in theory be different. In other words, a defendant's argument for why the district court should impose a given sentence might be different from the question of whether the judge could impose the sentence. Without a contemporaneous objection to the substantive reasonableness of a sentence, amicus argues, the appellate court might hear arguments raised for the first time on appeal that the district court never had the chance to consider. This is consistent with the purpose of the default rule that objections must be made contemporaneously to ensure that a court has the best possible arguments and information before making a ruling. The amicus also argued that the Fifth Circuit rule creates consistency between substantive and procedural errors at sentencing, since the Supreme Court has held that procedural errors must be objected to in the district court at the time they occur if they are to be preserved. Oral arguments were held on December 10th. Many of the justices' questions focused on understanding the real-world effects of the parties' positions and to understanding where, in fact, the parties disagreed. The second issue was caused in part by the parties' focus on different aspects of the question presented. The petitioner emphasized the timing of the Fifth Circuit's objection requirement, which the question presented described as, quote, after, end quote, the sentence is imposed. At oral argument, the amicus conceded that a rule requiring an objection after sentencing could not be squared with Federal Rule of Criminal Procedure 51B. Instead, the amicus focused on exactly what information had to be included in an objection, and whether a simple argument for a shorter term, as the question presented put it, was sufficient on its own to preserve an objection to the sentence. The government took a middle ground of sorts and agreed that a defendant who advocates for a shorter sentence preserves a general substantive objection to the subsequent imposition of a longer sentence by asking for his or her preferred sentence. But the government also insisted that if a defendant should receive merely plain error review for any specific argument about why a shorter sentence was required if that argument was not advanced at the time of sentencing. Holgan Hernandez was represented by Kendall Turner, the counsel at O'Melveny & Myers, who was making her Supreme Court debut. Justice Alito asked a few questions about whether there was anything preventing a defendant from arguing that he or she thought one sentence would be best, but a range would be reasonable. Ms. Turner said that it would depend, but in general, if a defendant said any sentence within a range would be reasonable, perhaps he or she would not have preserved the argument that the sentence should have been at the low end of the range. Justice Sotomayor pointed out that the amicus seemed primarily concerned with ensuring that defendants give notice to the court of the reasons a sentence is appropriate under 353A, not the timing of the objection. Ms. Turner responded that in reality, defense counsel always give reasons for their preferred sentence. Justice Sotomayor, the only former district court judge on the court, commented, "I agree with you. It never happened in my experience." Ms. Turner's response was that the ordinary fair notice standard for preserving objections should apply at sentencing, and that that question is heavily fact-bound and context-dependent, as well as being outside the question presented. Assistant to the Solicitor General Morgan Ratner argued on behalf of the United States. As I mentioned, she focused on delineating the scope of the government's argument and emphasized that an argument pre-sentencing for a particular sentence does not preserve either subsequent procedural errors, such as a judge's failure to explain the reasons for the sentence, or specific reasons the sentence might be substantively unreasonable if the defendant did not in fact advance those reasons in the district court. In other words, like the amicus, the government thought that new arguments raised on appeal for why a sentence was substantively unreasonable would be reviewed only for plain error on appeal. During questioning, Justice Kavanaugh drew from his experience reviewing sentencing appeals and noted that, in my experience, A substantive unreasonableness claim is almost always coupled with a procedural failure to explain claim. An objection for failing to explain a court's reasons for a sentence often merges substantive and procedural issues. Ms. Ratner acknowledged that even if this is so, a defendant must make a specific objection to a procedural claim, which can only happen after the error actually occurs. The same defendant could, however, make a substantive claim based on the reasons given for his or her preferred sentence, which would be reviewed for abuse of discretion. Justice Kavanaugh also pointed out that even substantive sentencing errors that are not preserved still get reviewed by appellate courts, albeit under a plain error standard of review. He said, referring to substantive reasonableness, quote, when you actually apply it in practice, end quote, it is a lot like plain error. He added that, quote, I'm not sure how a judge can keep all that straight. And he followed up by asking, can you imagine a sentence that's substantively unreasonable but not plain error? Ms. Ratner answered that there's, quote, a small sliver of daylight between the two standards, end quote, and the amicus later agreed that the functional difference between the two standards was quite small. In response to questions about how a judge should evaluate the substantive reasonableness of a sentence when some arguments are preserved and others are not, Ms. Ratner explained that appellate courts will often assume that all arguments had been preserved if it would make no difference to their ruling. Alternatively, courts could look at the preserved issues first and then examine whether any of the unpreserved issues would make the court doubt the reasonableness of a sentence. Justice Sotomayor asked the government, how do we write this opinion, which is one of the questions oral arguments most hope to receive, because the premise is that the court agrees with you on the law. Justice Sotomayor seemed to want to know whether it was enough to simply say that the Fifth Circuit test was too inflexible, or did the court have to say something about exactly what a defendant had to say at sentencing to preserve an argument. Ms. Ratner answered that there would be, quote, significant value in the court offering some clarity, end quote, about which arguments are or are not preserved. And on the other hand, she warned that there could be some potential for confusion depending on the way the court addressed this issue. As I mentioned, Kay Wynn Allen argued as the court-appointed amicus in favor of the Fifth Circuit's rule, and this was his first Supreme Court oral argument. Justice Kavanaugh started the questioning by asking why, as a practical matter, should advocates have to make an argument that is not going to have any effect? And he returned to the theme later, pointing out that most of the grounds for a given sentence will have been identified in the sentencing memos and at the sentencing hearing, and if they've all been identified there, do you have to raise them again? Mr. Allen answered no. As long as arguments about the maximum reasonable sentence are made somewhere, that is enough. Justice Kagan pressed Mr. Allen on the timing of the objection, and he conceded that Rule 51 does not require objections to be made after the sentencing decision. Justice Kagan later asked whether amicus's position carried over to other objections, i.e., whether parties had to object that every adverse decision by a district court was an abuse of discretion or clear error. Mr. Allen said no. Sentencing is different because of the, quote, guided nature, end quote, of the court's discretion and the special obligation the court has to explain its decisions under the Sentencing Reform Act. During petitioner's rebuttal, Justice Sotomayor pressed Ms. Turner to identify the differences between petitioner's position and the government's, and Ms. Turner said that we both agree that the fair notice standard applies, but we might find more arguments had fair notice than the government is willing to concede. She added that while a defendant needs to preserve the legal grounds on which he or she is relying, every fact and circumstance need not be explicitly referenced. But it is not entirely clear how this is different from the government's position or what the doctrinal source of those differences is. In light of the oral argument, I think the most likely outcome will be a narrow opinion reversing the Fifth Circuit's rule and clarifying that a defendant's request for a specific sentence is sufficient as a general matter to preserve a substantive objection to the longer sentence. It is more difficult to predict whether the Supreme Court will try to venture into providing additional guidance, as the government requested, about what fair notice requires when preserving specific arguments about why a sentence is unjustified. It's also unclear whether the court will address anything about the distinction between plain error review and substantive reasonableness. Certainly, defense counsel and prosecutors will want to review the opinion carefully when it is released to ensure that they are doing everything possible to preserve sentencing arguments for appeal.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCOTUS Cast. SCOTUS Cast is a project of the Federalist Society, a not-for-profit educational organization of conservative and libertarian law students, law professors, and lawyers, founded upon the principles that the state exists to preserve freedom, that the separation of governmental powers is central to our Constitution, and that it is emphatically the province and duty of the judiciary to say what the law is, not what it should be. Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast series, including SCOTUSCast and Practice Group Podcasts, on iTunes or Google Play. For an archive of past podcasts, as well as audio and video of past Federalist Society events, please visit our website at fedsoc.org/multimedia. That's FEDSOC.org/multimedia.
This has been a FedSoc audio production.